In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
There's an old saying, doing the same thing and expecting different results is the definition of insanity. Well, voting for the same politicians and expecting different results is also insane. Here in Oregon, our taxes keep going up, our forests keep burning, and our schools never have enough funding. The rest of the country is poised to do quite well, and we have a chance here in Oregon to also do well, but only if we stop electing the same people who are digging our grave. Welcome, this is the iSpy Radio Show. Today we're going to continue our look at natural resources. Last week, we talked about the Pebble Mine and how they're finally able to get to the permit stage. There's $500 billion of gold, copper, and other minerals just waiting to be plucked from the earth. Here in Oregon, we have trees, lots of trees, and no matter how many times you cut them down, they always grow back. But instead, the current politicians just decide to let them burn. Oregon wants to pass a new tax to raise $600 million to pay for health care, when we just spent $500 million to fight fires that were allowed to burn out of control. Sure, let's hand them some more money, because I'm sure they'll suddenly be responsible with money if only they had even more of it. Insanity. On today's show, Dr. Bob Zibat to talk about the forest, and then we'll talk with Sam Carpenter, who's running for governor on the Republican side, and he may have a real chance to get Democrats to vote for him. Here's a hint. It's not about reaching across the aisle by giving up your principles, which is what so many of our current Republicans think they need to do to attract Democrat votes. Stay tuned for that. I'd like to welcome Dr. Bob Zibat. He holds a PhD from OSU in environmental science. His academic focus was in wildfires. Certainly had a lot of those this last summer. And he is one of our longtime consultant for ISY Radio on forestry and logging. Dr. Bob, it's always great to talk to you.
Well, thanks, Mark. Good to hear from you.
Yeah. So last week we interviewed Mike Heatwald of the Pebble Mine, which was finally able to submit their mining permit. As part of that discussion, though, we dealt with the responsible harvesting of natural resources. And this is something that the environmentalists, and whenever I say environmentalists today, I'm almost always going to be referring to the extreme environmentalists. Anyway, that's really something that they're missing, is this notion that we've become more and more responsible environmentally. Why do you suppose that the environmentalists, though, why are they so opposed to harvesting practically any natural resources? It seems whenever a business wants to harvest natural resources, whether it's gold or copper or timber or whatever, the environmentalists are there to immediately jump in and throw themselves in front of industry.
Well, I think the environmentalists are the useful idiots, the ones we're talking about, the extreme environmentalists, the ones that climb trees and beat drums and get in the newspapers and that. But I think the real problem is the lawyers, the environmental lawyers. They're the ones filing suits and everything, and they're using the environmentalists as a way to gather funding. I think it's been somewhere around 30 years ago or something that it became possible for private citizens to sue the government as far as resource management, and if they prevailed, the government paid money.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole lucrative industry that came out of nowhere with the EPA and wilderness and that. The environmental lawyers were invented. There was a whole new industry, and a lot of their success has spelled failure for our rural communities. Loggers, people that work in the woods have all been displaced by these suits. And then it's not even a matter of prevailing anymore. Most of these have been settled with what they call sue and settle agreements.
Yep, exactly.
So it's I think we can blame the environmentalists there, but it's the gambling chasers, the real the lawyers on both sides of the fence, the ones that file the suits, and then the ones that represent industry and the agencies that combat them and lose.
Well, and we
both of them are getting paid well to do that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, we've also seen it with some of these larger environmental groups where that's part of their funding model.
Some of them, it's all of their funding almost.
Yeah, exactly.
The Biological Center.
Yep, Defenders of Wildlife. Several of these other really large ones. I mean, that's a major portion of their funding. So the biggest area where Oregon is blowing it in terms of natural resources is its mismanagement of its forests. This last summer, we allowed over 1 million acres of forest to burn, more than the size of Rhode Island. The figure that I saw was that we spent about $500 million to fight those fires. Is that pretty accurate, those figures?
Yeah, I think we spent about $500 million to fight the fires. And then with work I did researching the cost of fires 6 or 7 years ago, the actual cost is somewhere between 4 and 10 times that amount.
Mm.
And the reason being, look at all the unhealthy air in Portland, well, along the whole I-5 corridor during the last summer. Look at the lost revenues from lack of recreational opportunities. Look at the impacts on wildlife. Millions of animals died during those fires. So the fires are predictable. They all occurred on federal land, not state land, but the state is now managing their forests in such a way that they will have the same type of result if they don't turn the corner, which will be a predictable, they'll burn up in fires.
Yeah.
Then the lawyers will go to court, and then it'll be fighting for black-backed woodpeckers instead of spotted owls or marbled murrelets.
Wow. Well, you mentioned the extensive cost to all of this. If we'd been practicing active fire management and prevention, how much would we have spent on doing that instead?
Well, from 1951 until 1987, we had one major, being over 10,000 acres, one major forest fire in western Oregon. So in 36 years, there was one major fire, the Oxbow Fire on the Smith River in, I think, 1967 or something. Last year, just last summer, we had 10 major fires. They were all on federal land, and one of them was the third reburn on Calmeopsis Wilderness. So from 1951 to 1987, we had one fire, and we pulled in billions of dollars in products. Wildlife flourished, our schools and parks were created, a lot of them rebuilt. Recreational opportunities were at an all-time high and remain so, wonderful campgrounds and everything else. We didn't need to be suppressing fires because we were actively managing the forest for the benefits of everybody, not for the supposed benefits of a bird or a salamander or fish of the week.
Right, but you know, we spent $500 million on fighting those fires. What would it cost us instead to be preventing those?
That was the point I was trying to make. We would make hundreds of millions of dollars in fighting the fires that cost us nothing, because the income from managing the forest would greatly exceed any prevention or suppression costs.
Ah. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Don't forget, Speak Life 2018 with Mike Huckabee is this weekend, Portland, Salem, and Medford. You can save $5 per ticket by using iSpy Radio, all one word, as the discount code when you order your tickets at OregonLifeUnited.org. That's OregonLifeUnited.org. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Bob Zybak, talking about natural resources and in particular about Oregon's timber and forestry industries. And you know, just to clear up a little bit something from the last segment, in my head, what I was thinking is, when you look at it from the state spending that money, in terms of we spent roughly $500 million fighting fires that we didn't need to, versus what minimal amounts of spending we would have to do if we were just managing things. And you had a great analogy during the break there where you mentioned that it's kind of like doing maintenance on your car. If you're putting oil in your car, just a regular part of operating that car, that's, you know, minimal amount of investment, versus not putting any oil in and eventually your engine seizes up and suddenly you've got this $10,000 bill. I think that's a great analogy. And just to even take it a little further, what you were saying was that when we were doing things correctly and private industry was out there actively logging the forest out there, part of the revenue from that went to the state as an excise tax in order to pay for fire prevention. So again, we lost $500 million on something that would have been essentially revenue neutral in terms of coming in from private industry. So did I sum all that up correctly?
Well, I think the point, though, is it's not only is it revenue neutral, it's the massive profit.
Yes.
It's just, it becomes a cost of doing business rather than the business. So
right.
Now there's the businesses fighting these fires, and it's really lucrative for people that fight fires seasonally and the people that don't own those companies. But 40 years ago, it was a cost of doing business as a road builder or a logger or a tree planter, and so this was just an attendant cost rather than a revenue neutral situation. They didn't have fires, so there isn't a comparison that way.
Well, and also on top of that, like you said, is they're making money out there harvesting this timber. So let's look at it this way. Is the million acres that were burned up and lost, how much could we have made if the timber industry had been out there harvesting all of that wood?
Right now, we should be out there harvesting that wood because it's still in good shape, even though it's dead. It is a lot more susceptible to wildfire now, as the Chetco Bar fire shows, where the Calmaniopsis has burned three times. So right now, what happened in the Columbus Day storm, millions of feet, hundreds of millions of feet of timber blew down on a Friday afternoon, and by Monday morning, the agencies and industry had gotten together and put together a salvage plan. What's happened with the Calmaniopsis, why it keeps burning up, is it took years and years to get just a piddling amount of salvage done. And by that time, the wood is degraded and it's worth a lot less. So if we went in right now to all of those 10 areas, maybe not into the wilderness areas because you can't have anything mechanical for regulatory reasons, but went into those areas and begin salvaging the material, that would bring in millions of dollars. It wouldn't probably offset the $500 million that was spent watching the fires, but it would bring in millions of dollars and create thousands of jobs. And it would be an economic boon to rural communities that were subjected to these events.
Right. But just to add to that, let's say that rather than losing a million acres to a forest fire, we had actually harvested a million acres because we know the state doesn't want us to do that. What would be the difference there? Because, I mean, the effect is the same. You've got, you know, a million of acres in harvested timber versus a million acres in burned land.
I was castigated at Oregon State when I was going there because I pointed out that there wasn't a whole lot of difference between a clear cut and a wildfire other than
exactly.
The clear cut will not burn again and it doesn't kill a lot of wildlife while it's being logged. So a lot more wildlife dies in a fire, and the value of the wood is degraded. So there's a loss no matter what. But if salvage is not carried on, there's an unnecessary second loss, plus there's the danger of the reburn because all that pitchy conifer trees are dead and they're just like air-dried firewood at this point.
So what would have been the profit and jobs created from harvesting a million acres?
Well, it depends on the board foot and how many millions of board feet were burned up. And typically, a million board feet of Douglas fir is figured to be 8.8 or 10 jobs, depending who's doing the math. And then the value of the timber, you'd have to know that rather than the acreage to make an estimate on loss. But again, the real loss, now that those trees are dead, is going to be in the next several years as they either burn again or get bugs or cause injury or damage to people, certainly reduce the recreational experiences. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to put a figure to it without knowing the volume, and then the ownership of the lands, regulations like wilderness, that all of the trees that grow in the wilderness are worth zero, which is one reason I think they don't bother to put them out. But on the other hand, the Calmaniopsis was created specifically to protect rare and endangered plants in the late 60s. And the question now is, it's not being addressed, is how many of those rare and endangered plants have been impacted by the last three wildfires that have gone through there?
So in terms of the surrounding land that borders those million acres, what's the environmental impact of those? I mean, are those forests that are still standing, are they now more susceptible to disease and bug infestation, landslides, and so on, versus timber that had been harvested?
Absolutely, and not only that, they're in more danger of reburning. Right now, the fire on the Chetco Bar is, I think, within 6 or 7 miles of Brookings, and the Forest Service has got some plan to do, like, I don't know, 1,300 or 13,000 acres of public comment. So, you know, the old piddle around and let it burn again. So there's an increasing danger from those trees because the reburn has a lot more fuel in it, and it burns a lot hotter, and the fire spreads a lot further, And the evidence can, a lot of people aren't familiar with the six-year jinx of Tillamook fires from 33 to 51, but they should become familiar with the 16-year jinx of, or 15, whatever it is, of the 1987 silver, the 2002 biscuit, and the now the 2017 Chetco bar. All of those are happening in the same area, reburning and expanding their perimeter. The same thing happened in Tillamook. Probably the same thing happened in the 1800s with the Aquinnah and Coos fires.
Well, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, we're going to talk about what Governor Kate Brown has learned as a result of all of this. Stay with us. And welcome back. Continue our discussion with Dr. Bob Zybak. He holds a PhD from OSU in environmental science, and his academic focus was on wildfires. So with all the wildfires this last summer, do you think Governor Kate Brown has learned anything, or the state legislature has learned anything in terms of what we ought to be doing?
The answer, unfortunately, is no. And I think the problem is, it's not that they don't want to do anything, it's that they're ignorant. We don't have kids growing up on farms or growing up in logging communities anymore for a generation or two at least. And so people really don't understand what the issues are. They don't understand the biology. And rather than depend upon their own experiences and knowledge, which doesn't exist anymore with most voters, they're dependent on computer printouts, people doing modeling saying that if we log a tree, a spotted owl will die, or black-backed woodpeckers will be dispersed, or critical to a coho or something. They've got a legal argument in which a lawyer can get paid a lot of money for putting a halt to people working. And that's the reason we're facing these fires right now, and a reason that we're also dealing with a lot of economically devastated rural communities and rural families.
You know, we had had some high hopes that the Elliott Forest issue might be resolved, but it seems the openness that Governor Kate Brown had was just a stall tactic in the face of public outcry. What's the status now of the Elliott Forest?
Well, it was a stall tactic. She asked for new and innovative ideas and then totally ignored them. And instead, on the 4th of July weekend, I don't know if we discussed this or not, but on July 3rd, everybody has taken a four-day weekend. She and the state treasurer and the secretary of state were able to get the legislature to approve a $100 million bond that would somehow magically take care of their responsibilities as trustees to the state school lands. So
wow.
That way they did not have responsibility for managing the lands, and in the case of the Elliott.
So they're issuing a $100 million bond, which
yep.
means that we're being charged interest for that because you're essentially, you know.
Our children are. The ones that are
exactly.
supposed to be benefiting by the state school lands are going to be paying that thing off, not Kate Brown or those people.
Wow. That sounds like it's breaking the law.
All done under the 4-day 4th of July weekend. So there's a lot of government work that gets done under the cover of darkness, and that's some of it right there.
Wow. That is just absurd. I mean, talk about backwards there, because these kids should be benefiting from
yep.
the sale of that forest, and instead we're now indebting those same kids with the sale
yep.
of this bond. I mean, that is just absurd.
Yep, it seems that way to me, too.
Wow. I don't know if it's breaking the law, but it's certainly breaking the spirit of the law. That's just astonishing. So it doesn't sound like they have learned anything at all from this last summer.
I would say not. On the Elliott, that area is all second growth forest, despite all the media claims of old growth and ancient and critical and all that. It's all nonsense. That area burned off seriously in the 1868. It's been logged. There's been splash dams on it. It's all second growth. Maybe, I think, 0.71% is old growth. And what's going to happen is we've laid off over 400 people from the local communities that would be paying taxes and making money, and we're creating a firebomb.
Mm.
If we were actively managing it on behalf of the kids, the state projects there would be a $430 or $450 million income over a 20-year period. And you figure out 200 school districts in Oregon, that's a couple million dollars for each and every school district on average.
Wow.
That and 400 jobs is being lost, and that forest is only 90,000 acres. So you can multiply it by the hundreds of thousands of acres of passively managed federal lands that have been bursting into flames predictably since 1987, and you can see that it's been a economically devastating to rural Oregon,
sure.
Particularly the way our forests are being managed.
Oh, yeah. I remember an iSpy radio show a number of years ago when we first really started talking about this and the devastation that a lot of these counties had had as a result of the timber being stopped. You know, they used to have these fully funded schools. They used to have great roads.
Yep.
And instead, teachers were having to sneak home food in these kids' backpacks because they weren't sure they were eating at
yep.
night. So, I mean, it's just astonishing what we're talking about here. So let's say that Bob Zybak was in charge of the land board. What should we be doing?
First, I think we have to they want to decouple, and that sounds like a Gwyneth Paltrow novel or something, but they want to decouple the trust obligation from the Elliott. That's why they were trying to sell it. But what they should do, the state should do, is decouple itself from federal regulations that are both onerous and dangerous, because those regulations have been demonstrated to result in mass unemployment and mass wildfires. So we're killing millions of animals, we're polluting our air, and we're putting people out of work and forcing them on either to relocate or to go on government assistance in many instances.
So if Kate Brown was to stay in power, do you see any evidence that we would ever get to a point where our land is used responsibly?
Only if somebody talked some sense into her and she had the power to do something. But I think there's a large body of people in this state, in Portland and Eugene, not to mention names, that think that it's fine even to breathe the smoke is somehow natural or good for wildlife, or I'm not sure what their thinking is, but it's confused. And again, I think it's based on ignorance. I think they don't understand the actual issues, and there's nothing in the schools or in the media that would enlighten them.
Yeah. What a sad state of affairs, unfortunately. We are up against the clock with you. Dr. Bob, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. I've enjoyed it.
And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking now to Sam Carpenter. He is a successful businessman and business consultant from Bend. He is now also running for governor as a Republican. Sam, it's good to talk to you. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Mark. Happy to be here.
So we just got off the phone with Dr. Bob Zybak talking about natural resources, and I'd like to actually continue some of that discussion with you. But first, I thought we'd get to know you a little bit, especially for members of our audience that may not know a whole lot about you. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about your qualifications and your experience?
Well, I have been in the U.S. Senate race 2 years ago, and so as far as politics goes, I'm an outsider, except for that, and actually that polls very well compared to being an insider. I have a business in Bend. It's a call center. I have 48 people, and 95% of them are ladies. I've had it almost 34 years now, so it's kind of been a really good business for Bend and for me for all these years. And I have written a couple of books. One of them is a business repair manual. It's called Work the System, The Simple Mechanics of Making More and Working Less. Hmm. And it reflects my experiences with the call center. It's turned out to be a bestseller. It's in its third edition, I think the 12th printing, and it teaches people how to repair their broken businesses. And from that, I've evolved another business that's what we do, is we help people repair their broken businesses. And my partner and I have actually repaired over 500 businesses in the last 7 years, up to $500 million in revenue, but most of them under $10 million in revenue. So I'm very good at fixing broken organizations. And I've got a couple other little things going on, but I am a businessman, and I would like to take my expertise into Salem. And we all know that things need to be straightened out over there.
Yeah,
and I feel highly qualified as an outsider to go in there and do that.
Well, I was going to say, certainly with broken organizations, the state of Oregon is a target-rich environment for sure. You know, and things are pretty bad here in Oregon in terms of the atmosphere. You know, to be honest, My wife and I have seriously considered leaving Oregon, and she's a native Oregonian, and there's a part of us that's still considering that. We don't know what that would mean or what that would look like, but there's a big part of us that often wonders if Oregon is beyond repair until it finally hits bottom. I mean, look at California as another great example. So where do you even begin in terms of trying to fix Oregon?
Well, there's a lot of what I'd call low-hanging fruit in the repair part of this. And here's the thing. We could talk about the bridge study, which was $200 million, and the exchange that never happened for $300 million, and this latest CCO debacle, what was that, $150 million, all these horrible mistakes. But what people never talk about, what politicians never talk about, is the everyday dysfunction of the government. And so what my partner and I do is we go into businesses, and I'll tell you in 20 minutes we can figure out what the main problem is. And it usually has to do with systematic stuff, processes, documentation. And sometimes the brother-in-law really does not need to be the sales manager and needs to exit in a small business. There's all kinds of reasons for failure, but the major reason for the government is it's other people spending other people's money. It is incredibly dysfunctional, and nobody talks about that. All we talk about is more taxes to fuel this thing that keeps growing and growing, and the PERS obligation keeps growing and growing. We need to go in there, not with a scalpel, but with a chainsaw. And there's some things we can do to really repair things quickly in there, and that's what I call low-hanging fruit. There's so many things that are so obviously wrong that could be fixed immediately, a lot of them by executive fiat, really. But what we want to do is we want to have a red trifecta, and that is not just to put me in the governor's seat, but to take the House and the Senate and put them back in the control of the Republican Party, and that's doable.
Well, you know, back in the day, and my wife will tell you, is that back in the day, when Oregon was a successful state and the schools had plenty of money, it was an Oregon trifecta. You had Republican governors, you had Republican Senate, and a House. And that's when the state was still running well. So how do you go about bringing together those various groups in Oregon that you're going to need to get behind you? How do you get those groups to coalesce around you?
Well, we always go what I call a layer deeper when we attack a problem in a business. And the layer deeper part is some horrendous mistakes Republicans have been making. Now, one of them is that, oh, this is an oh-so-blue state. Oh, we've got to cross the aisle. No, it's 10% less Republicans than Democrats. It's 38-28. That has been a huge mistake. We're not that far out of the ballpark. Right now, independents, we've done a lot of polling, scientific polling. Independents are going Republican 52-37%. The other big mistake that's made is we don't pay attention to what's happening in the rest of the country. And there are 26 red trifectas, Mark, across the country. There's seven blue. One is California, which almost doesn't count because it's so far in outer space. But Oregon is one, and Hawaii is one, New Jersey is one. There's a couple other very small states back east. The trend has been to Republican control. 26 versus 7, 68% of our governors in this country are Republican. And get this, 68% of our House and Senate legislatures are both red in this country. So we Republicans haven't been paying attention to the rest of the country. We're so convinced this is such a blue state. It's not. And if we'd stop putting forth these cross-the-aisle moderate candidates for statewide office, like, you know, we put Dennis Richardson, won his first major win in 30 years, and he stood up on his hind legs and said, look, I'm conservative. I'm going to go in and mechanically fix this thing. And he was elected.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I'm running is kind of a side reason maybe, but I just can't stand to see it will happen again. To go in as a moderate, you know, trying to take care of the other side, make them happy and get some Democrat votes, and lose the base. Lose the whole base, which you need.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's go and take a break there. Come back, we'll have more with Sam Carpenter. You can visit his website at MakeOregonGreatAgain.com. You can also visit his Facebook page. Just look for Sam Carpenter for Oregon. Welcome back to Nice My Radio Show, talking to Sam Carpenter. He is a successful businessman and business consultant from Bend, and he is running for governor as a Republican And his website, MakeOregonGreatAgain.com. You can find out more about him there, or you can visit his Facebook page, Sam Carpenter for Oregon. And, you know, during the break there, we were talking about some interesting takes that you have in terms of reaching out to Democrats, and especially in terms of not bashing them. You know, we call them stupid and whatnot, and then wonder why they don't vote for Republicans. What are some of your thoughts in terms of how you get Democrats to vote for you?
Well, that's it, and that's one of the other mistakes we Republicans in Oregon have been making is so much of our base, so many of our politicians have just been trashing, if not between the lines directly, doing it directly is calling them names and saying, why can't they be sensible? Why? Come on, you guys, don't you see this is reasonable? They're just idiots. And so we're really referring to the progressive far left leadership, and actually that is a good description.
Yes,
you know, of the far left leadership, but they don't represent all the Democrat Party.
Yes,
Democratic
Party. I think there are a lot of everyday Democrats out there that are looking for an excuse to vote for a Republican.
Yeah, and if we're calling them names, why should they do that? And they'll stay home. Mm-hmm. And so we are not going outright praising Democrats. We're just refraining from calling them names. Well, I was a Democrat once. I get it.
Well, and I really think that that's how Trump got elected, was he gave enough Democrats reason to vote for him, and that he wasn't this evil Republican. And, of course, you know, the Democrat leadership and the mass media as well tried to point him out, paint him, I mean, as some sort of, demonic entity in some ways. But I think those Democrats, you know, they want their businesses to succeed. They want their families to have safety and security. So those are the things that I think that where there's some real commonality there. You stop seeing them as Democrats and you start seeing them as just fellow human beings.
Well, they are. They live next door. They work with us. They're at the Christmas table with us. They're our relatives. They're fine. They're regular people. They're Democrats. We're Republicans. But the far left, you know, they are the problem. I don't mind calling them names because they are the problem. It's not the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So let's talk a little bit about natural resources. That's really the focus of this week's show. In our talk with Dr. Bob, he really laid it out for us in terms of what we ought to be doing. So let's say that you're governor there. What approach would you take to land management?
Okay, land management, it depends which land you're talking about, of course. OMC, federal, you know, being sure. The Forest Service and BLM, and state forests. So generally speaking, without getting too far into the politics, a governor of Oregon has a lot of power and a lot of influence. And how much power do I have over what happens on the federal lands? Quite a bit, because I can make a phone call to a guy who will talk to me back east. In the state lands are generally better kept. We could talk about the Elliott Forest, and that's a disaster. But generally speaking, the governor, if the governor knows what he or she is talking about, can throw a lot of weight around. And the problem has been with the politicians, with the exception of Greg Walden, the politicians are afraid to talk about it because they don't know about it. Why is it okay to clear-cut Douglas fir? Is that a bad thing? Not necessarily, as long as you replant it. Do you clear-cut on the east side? No, you don't. You selective cut, generally speaking. How can we clean it up? Why are these forest fires burning? What do we need to do? And what we need to do is mechanically clean it up and go in there and have some reasonable logging operations and talk about sustainability. It's such a far-left term, but it is really true. There's things we can do in the forest mechanically that have to be done. And the governor, depending on the type of land it is, who owns the land, has a lot of influence to go in there and do what needs to be done and get the mechanical job done. And the neat thing is we can clean up these forests. I don't care who owns them. They can be cleaned up, and that job of cleanup can be paid by the thinning and the timber that is taken out. And, you know, the other side thinks you're going to clear cut. You just want to go in and clear cut everything and make it like the moon, which, of course, is ridiculous. But our kind of lily white Republicans are afraid to talk about harvesting timber. because they will be demonized. I will not be because I've got a background in timber.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but I think you're right in the sense that, you know, this is why the federal management is so very different from state management, is because you have people out in Connecticut and New Jersey and Delaware making decisions for us in Oregon, and they have no idea what these forests are like or how big this land is that we're in. They think in very narrow terms because that's their experience. Talk to us a little bit about your experience with the forest.
Well, I ran a survey crew back in the 70s for the U.S. Forest Service over on the Coast Range out of Wedderburn. And before that, I have a technical degree in forestry, which means I'm an on the ground guy, and I can run a chainsaw as good as anybody. But my experience in the forest is hands-on and silviculture related. I can cruise timber, and what I do know is that this non-management of the forest for the last 40 years has caused these problems.
Yes.
It needs to be managed, most of it like a crop.
Absolutely, and that's how I look at it as well. As long as you're replanting it and you're practicing good forest management, it will grow back and it'll grow back better than ever. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll be talking about some solutions applying a businessman's consulting mindset to Oregon. Stay with us. Speaking of business, 2018 is off to a great start with a real opportunity for businesses to expand and grow. Will your business be one of them? You've got to advertise. Thanks to the Trump tax cut, even here in Oregon, people will have more money to spend. But they can't buy from you if they don't know you're out there. We can help you advertise not only on this station, but our network of stations all across Oregon. We have some special deals right now for new advertisers, but you have to call us directly. Drop us an email at sales@ispyradio.com or 503-465-ISPY. Let us help you grow. sales@ispyradio.com or 503-465-ISPY. And welcome back. This is our final segment today on the iSpy Radio Show, talking with Sam Carpenter. He is a businessman and business consultant from Bend, running for governor as a Republican. His website, MakeOregonGreatAgain.com, and Sam Carpenter for Oregon is his Facebook page. So let's say that you're governor. What are the first steps to take Oregon?
We need to get into these department heads and get the right people in there. And anybody who doesn't go along with this new methodology, this new agenda, will be removed if I have the power to do that. And these committees, these steering committees, will have to see things my way, particularly if the legislature has been swapped around and from blue to red. That's the very first step. And I am really good at finding people who are experts, forestry. I have a forestry expert on the west side. I have a forestry expert on the east side. I know how to pick people, and that's a good CEO, able to pick the people who have all the answers. I don't need to have all the answers. I just need to have the people I have confidence in to have the answers, and they talk to me and talk me into stuff or talk me out of stuff, and then I move on to the next thing. It's a huge job. There's a lot of departments. But I'm really good at securing the right people to run the departments.
Farmers and miners. Trump called these guys the forgotten man. And I think in a lot of ways he was very right on that, because they were overlooked by government in terms of and overlooked in terms of the economy as well. Talk to us a little bit about the disparity between Portland and Eugene versus these rural counties.
Oh, my gosh. The big complaint I hear over and over and over from the outer areas outside the Eugene to Portland corridor is that Salem has forgotten the rural areas. Now, there are 275 towns in rural Oregon of 5,000 population or less. This is the new inner city, devastated by what happened in the early 80s with the stopping of the natural resources, activity, the timber. Anybody from Portland down through Eugene should just drive through the state and pay attention as they drive through these small towns, devastated. And it does go back to what Donald Trump said about offshoring and too many taxes, too many regulations, and too many immigrants coming in and taking the jobs, and so the wages remain low. Here's something, Mark. Cottage Grove had 22 mills in 1978. Average wage, $20 to $25. Take inflation into effect, those guys, and they were mostly guys back then, should be making $50 to $60 an hour choker setting. Okay. Yeah. Oh, wait a minute, I forgot. There's no choker setting. There's no logging.
Right.
So if you can imagine people going out in the woods and making a decent wage, oh, you'd find people to work. And
sure.
In these small towns especially, which I have a place in my belly for these small towns because I'm a small town guy, this could repair, fixing up the forest could really fix up these small towns as we go in to repair these forests.
I think I had seen a statistic one time that the average wage for the forest industry was $50,000, and that's certainly nothing to sneeze at. Earlier, you had talked about what's happening in the rest of the country with Republicans taking full control in 26 states versus 7 for Democrats. And, you know, I really foresee Oregon being in a world of hurt in the next few years if we don't break the Democrat stronghold on state government. Just this week, it was announced that Apple is looking to repatriate nearly all of its $250 billion it holds overseas. And in so doing, they expect to create 20,000 jobs, build a new campus, and add $350 billion to the economy over 5 years. All of this as a result of the Republican tax cuts. Meanwhile, Oregon continues to try to find new and innovative ways to squeeze more taxes out of its citizens and businesses, you know, the latest being this health care tax. What steps would you take as a governor to ride the wave of job creation that we're seeing in other states?
Well, first of all, we have to stop reaching across the aisle in the legislature. And that means we need to own the legislatures. We have spent so much time, and this is a real good answer to your question, Mark, we have spent so much time trying to reason with the other side. We have been so distracted with it. And if we put a Republican governor in there only, it's just going to be a nightmare of catfighting back and forth and back and forth. So the first thing we have to do is get control of the legislature. And then whatever I can do by executive order and is within my purvey, I will do. But we will go right after PERS first thing. And the second thing, okay, tied with the first thing, is this forest problem that we have here. We spent almost $500 million putting fires out in Oregon last year. $500 million.
Yeah.
Most of it federal money. But these are the two things. And then we go rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat down the line. And through the legislature and through whatever I can do personally, we start taking care of these things one by one. One by one, right after the other, until we get the worst 20% out of the way. And then we continue, bam, 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 on down with the legislature and getting this place straightened out. And it's everything. It's not just PERS in the forest. This is a whole lot of other stuff. And it has to do especially with the efficiency of the government on an everyday basis.
Well, you talked about efficiency, and that's certainly something that we've been saying for a long time here on this show. But the other thing that we often looked at is this notion that you get these bad administrators in there or these bad government workers in there, and they never get fired. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the Supreme Court's going to punch a big hole in, with this Janus case coming up, into that. And we are kind of stuck with a problem until the problem goes away on a federal level. But there is a lot I can do as a governor, very powerful governor position in this country, to go through and change the management of these departments and start there and work on down.
Hmm. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock with you. Sam, I want to thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks so much, Mark.
And thank you for joining us today on the iSpy Radio Show. We certainly hope that you're at least a little wiser for having joined us. Some websites and reminders before we go. OregonLifeUnited.org. That's OregonLifeUnited.org. The Speak Life event with Mike Huckabee in Portland, Salem, and Medford is this Sunday and Monday. You can save $5 per ticket by using iSpy Radio, all one word, iSpy Radio, as the discount code. Just see their Speak Life tab at the top of their page, OregonLifeUnited.org. Check out Sam's page, MakeOregonGreatAgain.com. That's MakeOregonGreatAgain.com. Email sales@iSpyRadio.com or call us at 503-465-iSpy if you want to grow your business and become an advertiser and sponsor here of our show. And if you missed any of that, head to iSpyRadio.com. Check all that out because, as we say every week, The best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.